From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when President Trump finally commented on the federal stimulus negotiations. Now, the president declared that $600 per person in stimulus checks was not nearly enough, a position that stunned both political parties. Republicans have pushed back against individual checks at all from the government. You might have heard Congressman Tom Reed on this program saying he doesn't think that's a good way to go, especially in the form of universal basic income and individual checks. Now, Democrats have pushed for more. The president was essentially siding with Democrats who jumped on the opportunity to restart that effort. The stimulus bill passed with a $600 individual check plan, but House Democrats passed their own measure yesterday to increase that number to $2,000, and Senator Chuck Schumer says he'll try to get the Senate to vote on that plan today. But what about the rest? What about unemployment insurance? What about state and local aid and the impact on local budgets? What about child care and help for struggling parents? What about the impact on businesses? Our first guest this hour is the director of policy at the Children's Agenda, Pete Nabosny, who helps us understand policy. And we'll take a close look at a lot of these issues. Pete, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What's the biggest headline that comes out of this stimulus plan to you here, Pete?
Well, to me, as someone who's been paying attention to the negotiations around this for a while now, is the fact that it happened, that it was
that it happened at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think the House passed their version of the HEROES Act back in May, and since then we've been sort of waiting for the next batch of assistance to come, recognizing a lot of these programs were phasing out, and that folks were going to lose unemployment benefits and all sorts of things at the end of the year. So the fact that they came to an agreement itself is the big headline, but then we can get into the details, which are also very important.
No,
I
take the point, and what we're looking at here, just under $1 trillion, it's less than the previous efforts last spring. Not nothing, but when it comes to what stands out to you substantively, let's go down the list. What's the most important thing in this plan?
Well, I think for the folks who have been most impacted by the effects of the pandemic and the kind of related public health closures and everything else, the extension of unemployment insurance is of an incredible relief. Unemployment in the United States is a pretty stingy program, and it excludes a lot of types of people who earn income, you know, people who are gig workers and things like that normally, as well as the benefit itself is pretty low. So this continued kind of this pandemic unemployment insurance program, but also continued this kind of add-on to someone's normal unemployment insurance check, which had been $600 a week, and it's now down to $300 a week, which is on top of what you're getting out of the sort of formula for unemployment insurance, which in New York for an average age earner, you know, someone making $50,000, which is about half of your normal earnings. So $300 in addition to that gets people a little bit closer to wage replacement, which is really important for people to maintain, you know, paying their bills, being able to, afford rent and food and all sorts of other normal expenses as well as extraordinary expenses. And it's particularly important because, as we're seeing in this community, we still have this terrible pandemic that we're encountering. So it's very difficult for people who work in particular sectors who have skills in certain industries to find work. So they get laid off because the restaurant that they work at, or there's someone who works in the entertainment industry, something like that. There just aren't the jobs in those sectors for them right now. So the best thing we can do to get through to the period when hopefully this pandemic is behind us and those folks can continue to work in the industries that they are skilled in, is to provide, you know, substantial unemployment insurance payments to them, so again they can they can stay in their houses, they can feed their families, they can do all those things that are important to them.
When you say, Pete, typically unemployment is stingy, is it because of who is included and excluded from possibly getting the benefit?
Yeah, it's both. I mean, I think with the unemployment, it's both who's included and excluded, and then the amounts. Right. So the American economy has evolved a lot over time, and you have a lot of folks who are, whether they're self-employed or, again, they They're sort of gig workers. They don't have the kind of standard employment arrangements. They're independent contractors, things like that. In normal times, unemployment insurance, it doesn't often cover them. It was designed in an earlier era where everyone was, employed in sort of the traditional kind of way with certain employment protections. So there are just a lot of people who are just kind of normally categorically excluded from unemployment. And what we've done during the pandemic is make sure that those folks are included. On top of that, the amount of money that someone typically gets from unemployment insurance just isn't all that high, particularly when compared to European countries. And there's this real trade-off that exists in public policy around, well, how generous to make unemployment insurance. Because on the one hand, you have folks who say, well, someone gets laid off, the best thing for them is to find another job quickly, which, is true in a lot of ways. You don't want skills to deteriorate and things like that. You do want, folks to kind of keep moving in the job market. So those folks advocate for having the unemployment program be fairly stingy, as I'm saying, the wage replacement being pretty low. On the flip side, you have people who say, well, if it's higher, then that person may stay on unemployment for longer, but they're going to find a better fit for their particular skills. If I got laid off today because the Children's Agenda, donations were down this year and we didn't get the grants we're hoping for, which, knock on wood, isn't happening. If I was getting basically nothing in unemployment, I would have to take whatever job was immediately available because, I've got two kids and a mortgage and all those kinds of things. But if the unemployment program is a little bit more generous, then maybe I can, take a little time on that program, continue looking for work, but really find that best next job for me. And that's socially, it benefits everyone if people are in a job and career that again matches their skills, allows them to kind of contribute as best they can to society. So there's some trade-offs within that program, and typically in America we've sort of erred on the side of let's get people back to work as quickly as possible, and that just doesn't fit the pandemic environment that we're in right now, where part of the goal is to keep people safe and at home, particularly who work in certain sectors that just can't operate safely right now.
All right. So last point then on unemployment and the weekly checks now. $600 was what came out last, I guess, March. I mean, go back to last spring.
Yeah.
That ran out. This time around, the number is $300. That's right, Pete?
Yeah, $300 per week.
$300 on top of whatever your state is offering. My understanding is that $300 per week is supposed to start going out immediately and run until at least mid-March. And when you talk about, the trade-offs of how much unemployment insurance to offer, that $600 a week, does that encourage people not to go back to work or to, as you say, maybe the benefit being patient and finding the right kind of work? Where does $300 fall on the scale of not too much, not enough, a sweet spot?
Well, it's certainly a lot more than is typically offered. So that's encouraging. And it's particularly helpful for lower income workers because of the way that the program has been structured. Having a flat $300 on top of whatever the formula offers you, someone who's typically making $30,000 a year, somewhere, in that range, they're basically getting full wage replacement right now. And as your income goes up, you're not getting that. What you're getting through the unemployment program starts to diminish compared to what you typically earn. And so, again, people who are at kind of the lower end of the income spectrum in terms of wage earnings, it's getting them close to whole, or in some cases, making them whole, particularly for people who are minimum wage workers. The higher up you go in terms of people who are typically earning, $100,000 a year, someone who's doing pretty well, that $300 that, $1,200 a month, it's not replacing at the same rate because unemployment insurance programs are incredibly clunky. We haven't really invested them in certain ways. The way the federal government can kind of add to the state programs, they can't just have them kind of increase the match per person. So they've had to figure out this flat add-on, which just has some sort of distributional aspects to it that are a little tricky, but are definitely weighted towards lower wage workers, which I think is important. I mean, that's the way I think we should go. But it's also important to recognize that people who make a good living, who have a lot of expenses, the $300 doesn't go as far for them for quite obvious reasons, I guess.
Talking to Pete Nabosny, the director of policy at the Children's Agenda, about this new federal stimulus package, which got a lot of the headlines for the $600 individual checks, which could be up to $2,000. Doesn't seem likely, at least from my perspective, because the House passed the move from $600 to $2,000 yesterday. The Senate would have to do that, and there doesn't seem to be an appetite in the Senate to do that. But President Trump has endorsed it, and he's got a lot of sway in his party, so we'll see. The Democrats have endorsed it, so we don't know about that. You want to offer a brief word about the $600 versus $2,000 and where you see that, Pete?
Sure. So, one point just to make on before kind of moving into that is that the decision to include $600 checks into the bill that was passed, that was what sort of in the end shortened the length of time that the unemployment insurance program was extended. And I think that's an important trade-off to talk about. We're probably not going to be through the pandemic, unfortunately, in mid-March when this unemployment insurance extension expires. So we're going to be talking about this again. I can clear my calendar for your show on March 7th so we can chat about it again. But part of that is because there was this effort to want to send stimulus checks out to everybody who makes below a certain amount. And because the negotiators had sort of agreed on $900 million as the amount before getting to what would comprise it, as they added the $600, they shortened the length of time unemployment would be extended. So that's sort of important context for that discussion. The unemployment insurance extension is really targeted relief to people who have been most impacted. The checks, I think, are a recognition that a lot of people are struggling. They may not have lost work, but they may have new expenses and other changes in the life, or their earnings may be down because they work in a field that earnings are kind of more variable. So it's extending, some additional payment to them. I mean, I think you and I have talked about this a lot. I'm very supportive of unconditional cash payments, particularly to lower income people, because I think it gives them the resources to meet their needs and the flexibility to do so. So, I'm hopeful that somehow this $2,000 will come on top of what's already been, allocated, that can happen. But it's important not to sort of shortchange some of these targeted programs that are helping people who are really suffering right now in order to issue the $2,000. So as a supplement, I think it's great, but coming at the expense of things like, expanding SNAP, food stamps that we're doing through this, or rental assistance, some of these other programs, which doesn't appear to be the case, but I think the $2,000 on top of those things would really help a lot of people right now.
Okay. Well, when it comes to how governors feel about this, Governor Cuomo said yesterday that what Washington is doing this week is three drops in a dry bucket. He said, if you don't help states and local governments with their budgets, you might as well do nothing, because he said the real pain comes from the massive holes that states and localities can't fill in the same way that the federal government can. He says it's almost all pandemic-based. We're talking billions upon billions of dollars. And then we're talking draconian cuts as a result, some of which the governor has said will hit schools. Now, I know that's controversial, and in the last 9 months, there's been a lot of debate about whether it should be 20% of every department across the board, or whether it should be a little more thoughtful and not so clumsy. But the governor says, regardless of how you do it, there's going to be pain for those who need it the most, whether it's child care assistance and whether it's school districts like Rochester, which has only seen, people forget, this was a year ago. It feels like 5 years ago. It was a year ago that then Superintendent Terry Dade was talking about, laying off something like 100 to 200 teachers in the middle of a school year before kids got back from winter break. That feels like 5 years ago now because of what the last 12 months has brought. But it has been an awful, awful 12 months for the RCSD. The governor says more pain's coming because Washington did not come through. He's going to lobby, obviously, Joe Biden and Congress going forward here. But he views this as a failure in that regard. Do you?
Well, so there's a lot there. I mean, one, I think that the evidence is pretty clear from, declining, particularly like sales tax revenue, that states and localities really do need some additional support. And You know, it is it's really disappointing that wasn't included in this package. I think people can quibble over the amounts of the various items that were passed, but the big thing that was missing in terms of relief to sort of stabilize things was just the complete absence of state and local assistance. As far as I understand it, that was a real red line for the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell. And so eventually, after kind of debating about this for months, you know, Democrats agreed to a version of a lot of the other things they wanted in exchange for dropping that, which, you know, the governor is correct. I mean, it's going to make it a very difficult budget year when you're a state, unlike the federal government. As you said, you don't have the ability to run deficits, you know, in the same way. So the state's going to be looking at, you know, some combination of you know, tax increases and significant cuts as they try to work their way out of the hole, unless, as the Biden administration comes in, they really make a priority of this and find some way to get an additional aid bill through Congress, which is going to be difficult because all the things that everyone was really focused on, unemployment insurance and stimulus checks and all these other things that people were enthusiastic about, have been largely taken care of now. So it's hard to get a standalone state and local aid bill through after that. But to your other point, I mean, I think it is important also to contextualize that New York State was already in a significant deficit situation before all this, you know, the coronavirus is even something we're aware of. Mm-hmm. Last year at this time, the governor was talking about really significant Medicaid deficits, which had been sort of piling up for years. And the state had been doing some, we'll say, creative accounting to move money into future years and accruing a pretty big debt. So I think New York's particular, every state's struggling, but New York's particular situation is a combination of a lot of factors, some of which is our tax structure, some of which is that we were not in a real stable budget equilibrium before this pandemic hit us, and then the, you know, the loss of tax revenue is all on top of that. So yeah, it's going to be a really difficult budget year. You know, people are worried about cuts to really important programs like education, like Medicaid, like a lot of other aid to localities, and then again, that what ends up happening is those things really hurt the most vulnerable among us, who are the most dependent on, you know, various government services and support. So yeah, I'm really concerned about it. I wish it had been there, and you know, I hope they can find some way to include it in a future package, but it's a little difficult to see right now, given the environment in Washington.
Sure. And when I think of small C conservatives, I'm not talking about elected leaders. I'm just talking about Americans who consider themselves small C conservatives. They often talk about limited government. They're concerned about the debt and deficits. And I understand that. Now, I don't mean to be cynical, but the reality is, in elected office, if you're a Republican, you care about that when Democrats have majorities. You don't tend to care about that when you have the majorities. And that has been borne out by several decades worth of evidence now in Washington, in which the bigger deficits came when Republicans had majority power. It's a fascinating thing to watch. But I don't think voters don't care about it. And I know, Pete, there are some small C conservatives who do care very much about all of these questions of spending, et cetera, and debt. And they might hear you say, look, states can't run deficits like the federal government can. Federal government could step in and do more. What do you say to the really sincere, concerned small C conservatives who say, now it's too much, we're spending too much, you can't ask the federal government to do that, it's too much of a burden long term? What's the response to that, Pete?
Well, so, you know, I mean, a couple of things. One, I think it is important to recognize that we are in a, if not unprecedented situation right now, pretty close to it. You know, we have one of these pandemics about once every 100 years. I think a lot of, you know, conservatives, people who are concerned about spending and fiscal restraint and being responsible with, you know, public resources and all those things, would largely agree that, you know, this is a situation in which you do spend money to support people, particularly as we've had, again, all these real public health challenges and kind of economic contractions as a result of it. And I'm sympathetic to the fact that they would probably also say, well, that's why we should be more responsible in normal times, right? Like that, you know, this is why you have a rainy day fund, you know, because, you know, a rainy day will come eventually and you need to be, you know, more fiscally responsible when you when times aren't you know, rough or certainly like unprecedented like this. So I'm certainly sympathetic to that, and I think that there's some wisdom in there. At the same time, I think the concern about deficits and spending is often it's more of like a moral concern, you know, or a principled concern about living within your means and things that we should all try to practice as households and as individuals, that it doesn't apply the same way to government, particularly federal government, because of a lot of some complicated monetary policy things. So it's important, you know, to take into context what are interest rates, what is, you know, how expensive is it to borrow money, to all these other conditions that exist out there before you. Not every situation is the same. Not every fiscal situation is the same. And there are times in which, I mean, I took out a mortgage to buy my house. You know, I think that was still a pretty responsible thing to do. There are times in which even households borrow money. So, you know, I get all of that, and I think it's important. But it's also important to make sure that, you know, when people are suffering, that our government and our society is able to find ways to support them. And there's a lot of concerns within all that, and I'm sure that it's a whole other show that we could have around this. But we do need to be sensitive certainly to spending money responsibly and everything else. But we also need to recognize that the vast majority of this money is going to support people who are really struggling during an unprecedented time in any of our lifetimes.
Sure. In the last 2 minutes, I'll give you the floor to talk maybe about some of the things that you see that either weren't addressed in this bill that you think maybe on the local side or the state side there has to find a way to address. Or where you want to see the next priority go to, because there will be a lot of ink spilled about the $600 or $2,000, as you say, but that can be distracting to some of the deeper systemic issues. What's not there that needs to be there?
Well, so I'm still trying to figure out some of the details about what is there. So some of it's a bit tricky, but there's real targeted relief in certain areas that I think is appropriate. We haven't talked at all about there's an extension of the PPP program, which is a relief for small businesses and that pays attention to who's lost money over the course of this year, which I hope is helpful to you know, restaurants and entertainment venues. There's you know, money for performing arts and things like that. There's money for childcare, which is really important to supporting that sector. But so much of this program, as well as like SNAP and again all these other important programs, but so much of this comes down to implementation. How does, you know, New York State is going to receive a bunch of money from the federal government, which they can't use for any purpose, which is what they want. They can't make it them whole on their whole budget, but they can use it to help people avoid eviction. They can use it to help childcare providers keep the doors open despite lower capacity. They can use it to help small businesses. But so much of that is how does New York State, how does Monroe County, how does the city of Rochester, how do other governmental entities identify people who are in need of support, help them secure the support, help them through the process of, you know, paperwork and all those other things when these are businesses that are desperately trying to stay open, and how does that ultimately benefit, you know, families in our community? So the federal government is writing a big check with some guidelines, and so much of it's going to come down to our people on the ground in this community as well as in Albany to make sure that it works as well as possible for, you know, for the people who have been most affected by the negative consequences of the pandemic.
And I'll let our listeners know that after our only break here, we are going to talk about PPP, what was and was not there for businesses in this bill. Pete Nabosny is the director of policy at the Children's Agenda. Thanks, as always, for helping us stay up to date on this. And yes, let's talk very soon about what we know that's there and not there, because this will have impacts on the state and local levels, as we know, Pete, and we always appreciate your work.
You got it. Thanks for having me.
Pete Nabosny from the Children's Agenda. In a moment, we break. We'll come right back, and we're talking about the business impact. If you were wondering if the federal government is going to come in there and say, look, it's about time that we've got a specific targeted plan for bars and restaurants, if we're going to backstop those industries that have been told to largely shut down, we'll tell you what's there and what's not there in this bill next. Coming up in our second hour, we're talking about mindfulness and happiness as we face the pandemic winter. For a lot of families, isolation has been very difficult, especially over the holidays. The question now going forward is, how can we keep our mental health strong? How can we find mindfulness, a sense of spirituality or happiness in the coming months, especially before vaccines? We'll discuss next hour. Welcome back to Connections. My next guest is Jonathan Swan, owner of the Swan family of restaurants in Rochester, including Ox and Stone, Swan Dive, Daily Refresher, Dorado, Rue, and Vern's. John, welcome back to the program. How are you?
I'm well, Evan. How are you doing?
Good. Do I have your permission to read your Instagram post from last week?
Sure.
I'm going to read that first, and then what I'm going to do is I'm going to read from the Washington Post regarding this stimulus bill. But first, let me read what John wrote on Instagram last week that caught my attention and many others, frankly, in his industry. Quote, "Our governor knows exactly how proud small business owners are. He knew he could rely on us to make silent sacrifice, to be endlessly creative, to not give up, and to give everything we possibly have to be given. We've done that, and he's right. I'll never give up. But our leaders have been so concerned with saving lives that they forgot about also saving where our lives are lived. So I am through perpetuating the facade that things are okay. I will not continue to erode the very fabric of our society with misrepresentations of reality, because without help or a plan, your homes away from home are in serious jeopardy. Zones don't work. We need a new plan." End quote. That's John Swan on Instagram last week. Now, your colleagues chimed in with many comments, including, for example, quote, "It's almost like we've been closed down and forgotten about." A restaurant and bar industry, not just talking about Orange Zone and targeted closures, but just talking about an industry that's largely been at least partially shuttered for the year. And there's been talk for months about whether Washington should come in and say, look, you're not the auto industry, you're not the banking industry, you're an industry that had to mostly close because of something out of your control, and we're not going to let you fall apart. Well, here's from the Washington Post. Quote, "House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer issued a joint statement highlighting key provisions of the $900 billion coronavirus relief package this week, including important modifications to PPP, the Paycheck Protection Program, that they said would better assist independent restaurants. To members of the battered restaurant industry, which has seen its revenue plummet $130 billion compared with last year's numbers, the statement provided some hope that Congress had not abandoned the mom-and-pops of the hospitality sector, even if lawmakers opted not to include the Restaurants Act in this new deal. That act, introduced by a Democrat from Oregon named Earl Blumenauer, would have earmarked $120 billion specifically to help restaurants and bars with fewer than 20 locations. When it became clear that the Restaurants Act had little chance of getting through Congress, some lawmakers, as well as lobbyists representing the National Restaurant Association and the Independent Restaurant Coalition, pushed for modifications to PPP that they thought would provide partial relief to the hospitality industry. The bill would allow for restaurants applying for a PPP loan to use a new and improved formula. The formula, said Sean Kennedy, executive vice president of public affairs for the National Restaurant Association, reflects that the food service industry, the restaurant industry, has been uniquely and obviously affected by this pandemic. Other changes include greater flexibility on how small business owners can spend their PPP loans, all or some of which can be forgiven depending on how closely operators follow the spending guidelines. 60% of the loan must still be devoted to payroll, but the remaining 40% will now be available to spend on personal protective equipment, training protocols, modifications to the business property to protect customers, and even perishable items. The ability to purchase perishable items was particularly important to the restaurant industry," end quote. And John, the Washington Post goes on to say, this is not what the industry wanted. The industry wanted the restaurant bill, the Restaurants Act, to pass or to be included, and it was not included. Let's start at the federal level, then we'll talk about the state stuff. Is the what you're seeing this week, is it enough from Washington?
Well, I mean, to talk about the federal, the PPP loan, I mean, you have to kind of talk about the states too, because to make the PPP loan effective and forgivable, we have to be able to open our doors and employ people. Without that ability, the loan does not get forgiven. So it's a challenge for me to say that, it comes out and I see the news and I'm not jumping for joy, and I'm not saying it's not a help. It is a help. But it's definitely not the giant savior that some people might think it is.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts on this idea that that Congress could have gone with this Restaurants Act, $120 billion, proposed essentially to say we're trying to make whole an industry that has been crushed by this pandemic. How far would that have gone?
I think that would have went a long way. I think that would have been the safety net that we needed to have happen. When you look at the airline industry, for instance, that's an industry that is responsible for getting people quickly from point A to point B. They provide an extremely necessary service to the people. I would argue that restaurants serve maybe a more important service to the people. And you're talking about things like mental health, offering places for people to go meet others and discuss things. It's an extremely important industry that, in my opinion, has been kind of left out in the cold. They bail out the auto industry, the banking industry, the airline industry, not the restaurants, I think is a real failure. And I think it's also not really considering how people live their lives. It's almost been abandoned.
So let me go back to your Instagram post. When you say our leaders have been concerned with saving lives, but they forgot about saving where our lives are lived, let's talk about that. Because when you say I am through perpetuating the facade that things are okay, that's very direct from you.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, you're hurting, aren't you?
Yeah, we are. I mean, obviously, financially, it's pretty devastating. Mine and so many other restaurant groups are owned by, families and individuals that pour their heart and soul into a thing. And then one step further from that, and more importantly, I mean, you hire all these employees. For my group, it was 128 employees that had been laid off, the most of which on the day before Thanksgiving this year, when the zone idea went into effect. And I think that, like I was saying before, this idea of the third place that sociologists have kind of coined is a real, essential for people. It's the places you go, when you're not working and you're not home. It's the place you go to enjoy your actual life. And so many people try to distill down the COVID argument to, death and mortality versus, money and income. And it's just not that simple. I think too many people are quick to forget, we still have to live our lives. And while, deaths and sickness is a horrible, reality. It is the reality. We still got to keep living, though.
Well, John, I want you to address an argument that I've heard made by a number of people, not the least of whom was a former colleague of mine who is now a news director of a television news operation in Syracuse. And his feeling was that I have been too vocal in my public commentary about Congress's lack of action, for example, or the way other levels of government have addressed restaurants and bars. Because as he said, whenever there is disruption in a marketplace, there will be closures, there will be winners and losers. But then from the ashes of those losers, from the ashes of those closures, there will be others who open and other businesses will rise in their place. And he presented sort of an organic picture of, hey, you know, you can't intervene too much. And if some lose out and have to close, give it a little time and others will rise in their place. That is just the nature of life. It's a cycle. Don't fret too much. So what I told him, John, was I don't see this particular debate that way. What I see is the people who are going to win are the chains. And I always try to sort of buffer this by saying I got nothing against chains, but I do think we should care about individual and local ownership, independent businesses in many different industries, local ownership across industries. And if we're left with chains only and economic concentration, I'm not sure that is what we should be sort of shrugging our shoulders and rooting for, especially in the restaurant industry, where we do spend a lot of our time. How do you see it, given what, you know, my colleague said about, hey, from the ashes will rise new businesses?
Well, first of all, I think he's right. That will happen. The question that I would pose, though, is that the right thing to do? Is this one of those events that that necessitates putting individual restaurants to the brink like that? Now, you're talking about individuals that have opened their places out of passion. It's not always just this let's take over the world scenario for every business owner. Some people just truly love to cook and provide ambiance for people going out at night. I mean, that's what I love to do. That's what my family loves to do. And I know countless other restaurateurs in Rochester, that's what we're all doing. I think there's a huge misconception, with people's perspective about what it means to own a restaurant. You know, people, and there's almost like this weird paradox where people say, you know, they always say, oh my gosh, the restaurant business is so hard. And then at the same, you know, the same breath, they could say something like, well, that guy owns 5 restaurants. He must be extremely wealthy. Like, you know, it's just this weird thing that goes on in people's heads. So I think you know, restaurants would, you know, fill their places. And I also think that to be a little more cynical about it, I think politicians kind of know that. I think that they can rely on the fact that the next mom and pop are going to fill the shoes of the other place and just kind of forget about the person that made the first risk. And I think that's a sad truth. And I just don't think it's fair that COVID restrictions are the things that is the sort of thing that should put us in that position, because ultimately the governor has required individuals based on essentially zip code or how zip code and, you know, their relationship to proximity to a hospital, et cetera, to determine whether or not they can succeed. That's not normal market. This is not normal times. So I don't think you can make that argument as he has.
We're talking to John Swan, who is the owner of the Swan family of restaurants in Rochester. And let's talk about the Orange Zone designation then there, John, because I know that you and your colleagues have had a lot of problems with that. The governor's office might say, look, we have to make distinctions somewhere. And when you look at your case rate, when you look at the trend lines, we have to draw some kind of a boundary. And if you happen to be close to the edge of that boundary, it'll appear unfair, but we've got to draw it somewhere. What do you think, John?
I think that's completely erroneous. I think that still makes no sense. So the idea that you need to draw a line it makes no sense to me. People ultimately are going to go out if they want to go out. For instance, last night, Evan, the Bills played, and I wanted to go and have a beer with my friends and at a bar, and I did. I went to City Tavern out near the edge of town by Eastview Mall. It was about a 10-minute drive from my house. easy to go in. They put me into their dining room where there's tons of, you know, a bunch of other people all socially distanced and masked as they entered and four to a table, et cetera. But fact of the matter is I went out. It was not as busy as I anticipated it would be. And I think that lends some credence to the idea that people are going to police themselves. I think that there has been an extremely effective campaign to, I guess, instill, you know, enough fear into people about the spread of the virus and enough concern about the virus that people kind of police themselves. And I think that ultimately, as the governor, you need to expect people to do that. You also have to entrust business owners to enforce those kinds of things. There had, before the zones were introduced, if I had violated any of the restrictions that were in place, the masks and the distancing, et cetera, there was a $10,000 fine available for me. There was also, if it was egregious enough, I believe I could be put in jail as a business owner for violating those things. Now, you have a social responsibility. We're in the hospitality industry. Part of our passion is to take care of people and do it safely. We have an intrinsic, you know, there's intrinsic value to that too. When you do that, that correlates to people coming to visit your establishment again. So you're incentivized to follow the restrictions. And to be frank with you, Evan, we didn't find the restrictions to be all that difficult as we are difficult to abide by, because we're required to already by the health department, you know, to maintain clean facilities. We're checked several times a year to ensure that we're doing things like that. If we're not, we're, you know, you see restaurants all the time in the paper. Oh, here's a violator of the health code, you know. So I think that there was things in place to keep this under control. And I think also the general public had enough knowledge about COVID to control themselves. Also, the state's own data, as distributed by multiple news outlets, showed that the transmission rate in bars and restaurants was under 1.5% compared to like 75% in people's own homes.
Homesteaders,
they're still allowed to gather.
Yeah.
They're still allowed to gather in groups of over 10. So I don't know. It's a challenge for me.
74% of cases. This is based on 46,000 contact traced and sort of analyzed cases that the state published data on. 74% of those cases of COVID transmission happened in home settings, and just about a percent and a half happened in bars and restaurants. That's what John is referring to, and that is state data that he's referring to. Let me get Fred in Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, Fred.
Hey, I'd just like to say that I agree with you, Evan, that if the mom-and-pop places close, the only ones that will be left are the chains. Personally, I love to go out to eat, but I cannot remember the last time I was in a chain. But I was looking from an economic standpoint, what it costs to help out the mom-and-pop places with the loans, and compare that to what the revenue is for the state or the city or the county, however you want to, you know, parse it out, compared to what the revenue is for the chains, and what are the employees getting paid compared to the chains? You know, most of the people I know are making a lot more money at a local restaurant than they are at Wendy's or McDonald's. So, you know, and I'm sure the taxes that are paid to the state. So, you know, in the short run, it's going to cost the state some money to help them out. In the long run, if they don't, it's going to cost the state even deeper.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Fred. What do you think, John Swan?
I mean, he's got some valid points there. I think I can't speak to how my places compare to chain restaurants as far as pay. I think that we pay fair wage. But I do think there is something there. I do know that I'm collecting less sales tax at the moment than I ever have before, to a pretty astonishing rate. I'm doing about 30% of what I'm used to in a year. I collect a lot of sales tax. And, I mean, people forget that when you sign up to do business that you become an agent of the state to do so. So when you shut down an entire orange zone, you know, that directly impacts state income that we're all going to have to pay for at some point. Who knows how? So
in our last few minutes then, John, if you could, based on that Instagram post, I think a lot of people read that and thought, like, wow, John is really hurting here. He says things are not okay. And there's a question of how long can your restaurants be there? What's realistic now? Again, we do this not because we're trying to predict the future, nor are we trying to scare anybody, but to be realistic about what we are facing as a community. What's realistic for your restaurants? Could you see them closing? I mean, permanently closing? Could you see others in your industry closing soon?
I think that's an inevitable fact that many restaurants will close in the next month or two. So if I was looking, if I took passion out of this and a love of what I do out of this, the correct financial business move without any emotion attached is to close a few of mine. That is the right move. I've been fortunate to grow within a family that, you know, of restaurants that can kind of hold each other up and prop each other up here and there. Fortunately, I think the long-term effects here are what is really scary to me. This orange zone idea. I mean, you're basically putting this tarnished image of restaurants in just based on zip code out there for the public to, you know, do with what they want. And that's a really, really scary proposition. I mean, I have good days and bad days, Evan, about it, to be honest with you. I think I'm scared. I think a lot of my colleagues are scared in the industry, that's for sure. And I wouldn't be surprised, you know, to see a significant portion, upwards of 25-30% of the restaurants in the city go out of business. I saw that the Democrat and Chronicle published an article, you know, 50 restaurants closed in 2020 due to all sorts of different scenarios, but that's more than any other year, I guess, in a bunch of years. That's just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, let me close by reading a comment from Carrie, a local bar owner, who says, "We are struggling. The idea that it is okay to let some small businesses fail because more will just rise up through the ashes is extremely insensitive and obviously coming from someone who does not own their own business and has never experienced the blood, sweat, and tears that goes into keeping a small business alive. We do it out of love. We do it because we love the industry. Bars and restaurants are tight-knit institutions that function much like a family. To break up these families is heartbreaking, and to treat them like a throwaway business is cruel. It would be one thing if a small business was to fail because of their own mismanagement, but to have a thriving business fail because of no fault of their own, such as a pandemic, should not be ignored. Small business is the heart of cities and neighborhoods. Without them, we are just a homogenized society." That's from Carrie. 30 seconds, John. Does the county's action on food delivery apps, is that a small bit? Does that help you?
Yeah, I mean, it does help. I can't stress enough, though, that takeout is not part of the business that makes money for a restaurant. That's something to hopefully keep a few people employed during this, maybe to keep the lights on. But takeout business is a really tough business. It's very expensive to run, and most restaurants, when you build them out, are designed to do a certain thing, and it's not takeout in all cases. So when you convert to that, it becomes a really expensive proposition.
Yeah, I hear that. Well, John, I know it's not an easy time, and like I told you from the outset, your post was heartfelt, and I appreciate you opening up about it. I know it's a hard time for a lot of people in the industry, but I hope we can stay in touch, and good luck to you.
Thanks, Evan. Appreciate it. And thanks for helping amplify our message.
Well, I think it's important to hear from all sides as society tries to figure out what to do as we face this pandemic winter. That's Jonathan Swan, owner of the Swan family of restaurants in Rochester. And our thanks to Pete Nabosny from the Children's Agenda for joining us earlier this hour. We do expect to talk to Congressman Joe Morelli as soon as next week about what the federal government is doing or not doing in regards to the pandemic next and this stimulus bill. And we have more connections coming up in a moment.